When I consider that I'm considered the local expert in our area on SARS and my wealth of experience is one possible case and a bunch of rule-outs, and to see the experience that these physicians, dedicated healthcare professionals, have gone through with so much compassion and dedication and hard work, it's a real Kiddush Hashem. It's a real wonderful thing that they have done, and I wish them much success in combating this problem further. A rabbi gave a wonderful, long drasha to his congregation in Hollywood. And one of the congregants came up to the Rav afterwards and started telling him, you know, your speech was really good. Do you think you can condense it to about 5 minutes? The rabbi was thinking, he said, this person's a big producer. Maybe he wants to make a CD out of my drasha. Be a real great opportunity for me. You know, it was 45 minutes. Could I do it in 5 minutes? He told him, yeah, I think I could. So the producer said, then why didn't you? I have the unenviable task of about a 45-minute drasha now. And I hope most of you don't come up to me afterwards and say you're Hollywood producers. What I would like to do, what I've been asked to try and do, is address some of the halachic issues that a physician or the health caregiver might face in dealing with an epidemic like SARS. And I've heard already some of the specific issues and spoken with some of the doctors here about other issues that haven't been raised as of yet. And I'll try to address some of them, but obviously not all of them. And during the question and answer period, I hope people feel free to address any questions that they still have in their mind. I'd also like to very forcibly state that I'm not a posek of any stature whatsoever. I'm not a posek, period. There are wonderful rabbanim here, and it gives me an opportunity to thank Rabbi Kelman for inviting me. It's a great honor to be on this panel and this institution, which has done these symposia on a regular basis, and I know many of the previous speakers that they've had, and it's a real kavod and honor to be included in this group, and I thank Rabbi Kelman for giving me this opportunity. You need to go to your local competent Rav to ask shailas. When a guest speaker comes in, so he teaches you theory, gives you education. He's not a posek. You go to your local Rav, and the Rav who's familiar with all of the factors, he's the one that gives the psak, and that's how Judaism works. What I'm going to try and do is give you the background from the earliest halachic sources and go through time to the contemporary poskim and gedolim, the great sages, how they have addressed this issue and similar issues. As was mentioned earlier, Ein Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh, there's nothing new under the sun. For every halachic variable parameter that we could come up with, there's a solution in Chazal. Nothing is left unanswered. You just need to know how to look and where to look. And you need to have the background to look in the halachically correct way. So I'll give you some very early sources from both the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, and the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. I know people in the audience have a wide background and how much they will understand of this. I'll read very sparsely from the original Hebrew or Aramaic sources and try to translate everything. But please, even though we're waiting until questions at the end, there's something that I'm saying that I'm not translating appropriately or well enough. You know, just raise your hand and ask me to reiterate it, to explain it, and I'll be very happy to. One of the earliest sources that deals with infection in general literature and in halachic literature as well is the Gemara in Ksubis. In the end of the seventh parak on Daf Ayin Zayin Omud Beis, for those who mentioned the quotations, the actual sources, so those that either hear the tape or write it down if they wish to check up some of these references themselves, there's nothing like seeing the actual original source material inside. And the Gemara there talks about a very interesting disease, which I still haven't figured out exactly what it is, but it's some sort of CNS parasitic infestation. Possibly cysticercosis, but I don't think it's exactly what the Gemara is describing. And it talks about this illness known as the Baalei Rason. This is actually an illness that's mentioned in the Torah. Paro, in the times of Avram Avinu, was given certain plagues. Vayinaga Hashem nigoim gidolim. That's Paro. Paro was inflicted because of taking of Avram's wife Sarai, And he was inflicted with Nigaim Gidolim, great plagues, and the Mefarshim on that say it was this disease known as the Bali Rasa. The Gemara in great detail in Kisubos describes the neurosurgical procedure. This is several thousand years ago. The neurosurgical procedure goes through sterile technique, well before Semmelweis. Those don't believe me, again, look at the Gemara in Ayin Zayin and Mibayz. I'm not here to give a shear on neurosurgery, but the Gemara describes in some detail appropriate infection control. And then the Gemara quotes what happens to the care and the caregivers for such patients who had an extremely contagious disease. Whatever this disease was, the Gemara describes it as being extremely contagious. The most contagious disease that we find any mention of in all of our halachic literature. And the Gemara says, Machriz Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan announced, Hizaru Mizvuve Shobali Rasim. Be very, very careful about the flies. There could be possible vectors of infection. Zoonosis was understood by the Chazal well before it was a medical term. The possible transfer of infection from the flies that surround this patient to other patients. And what does it say? Rav Zeira lo habe yosef bezike. Rav Zeira didn't sit near these people that had this disease. He wouldn't sit downwind from them because of the potential contagion. I don't know if they were using BiPAP on them, but he wouldn't sit downwind from them. He understood how infectious droplets could potentially cause infection. Rav Elazar lo ayo biyale. Quarantine. He wouldn't go into the house. He wouldn't enter into the area where these sick patients were because it was a highly contagious disease. Rabbi Ami the Rav Asi, two great first generation Amorayim from Eretz Yisrael, lo havu achle mibei dahave mavot. They wouldn't eat from some of the foods in that area because this could be a foodborne illness possibly. There could be transfer of this illness via eating. Improper hygiene, not washing the hands. Nothing new under the sun. However, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, the great Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Nichrach Behu, the Osik B'Torah. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, I'm going to go sit there and learn Torah with them. I'm not afraid. The Torah will protect me. And he went and learned Torah with them. And the conclusion of the Gemara is that he was extremely successful in what he did. So successful that when he would end up eventually meeting up with the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death, he was able to take the angel of death's sword and not give it back to him until he let him go into Gan Eden without having to die. An amazing Gemara. I'm not here to discuss the spiritual aspects of this. You've got to go to your Rav and learn a little bit on your own too. You can't just come out for an hour at night and expect to learn everything in the Torah. There's so much in this stuff. You could spend hours analyzing this story in and of itself. But I want to focus in on the infectious disease aspects of this, the infection control aspects, and the risks of a physician going to take care of patients, not necessarily to go learn Torah with them. Or is that the key factor over here? The fact that he was learning Torah with them allowed him access that otherwise a physician or a healthcare giver may not have. So the Mefarshim discuss, the commentators, the Poskim discuss, is what Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi did halacha l'maisa. Can we all go into Baycrest, into any of the other hospitals? Can we just walk in there, disregard all the signs on the door and say, I got a chumash? Do whatever I want. I got my chumash. I'm going there to learn Torah. Torah is megid. Now, we all believe that the Torah is megid. The question is, can you rely upon this halachically and go in past quarantine? You don't have to wear an N95. You put your chumash up in front of your mouth. That's all you need. It's better than an N95. Is that halacha lemaisa? Can we rely upon that? So the Shari Mitzvayonim b'halacha, very contemporary posek. I'll try to, again, cut to the chase as often as I can. The Shor Mitzvayonim Balacha says that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi is the exception to the rule. He was such an unbelievable tzaddik, as evidenced by the rest of the Gemara. Any of you have the right to walk into any of these hospitals and disregard quarantine if you've recently had a conversation with the Malach HaMavis and taken his sword. It's not enough to walk in with the Chumash. You also have to have the Malach HaMavis, the sword in your hand, and then you have the rights to ignore normal infection control. So that's what he brings down. And he says, Umevu Hashem Dilidon, for us, Ein Lasus Kain. The person can't say that I'm going to rely upon the Torah and do whatever I want because I have a higher authority. God did not create us to bypass the natural laws. We have to do things in the normal way. Ein somchin al hanes. A person doesn't have the right to rely upon miracles to occur to him. Such a person, unless he's of the caliber of some of the great gedolim that the Gemara discusses, could bypass nature because they routinely bypass nature. Unless you're on that category, you have to follow the normal rules of science. So this halacha, this story, is not halacha l'maisa. One cannot rely upon this and say, I can do whatever I want. That's clear from the poskim. Are there other sources for a person being allowed, a physician, for example, being allowed to take the risk? Would it be acceptable for a physician to walk up to the chief medical officer in the hospital and say, we got SARS in our hospital, and therefore I'm no longer coming into work until there's not a SARS problem? Is that a halachically defensible? Is that halachically appropriate? Or is that inappropriate? What does the halacha have to say about a physician putting himself at risk? We heard, unfortunately, of physicians who have been killed in this epidemic so far. We have heard of nurses, other healthcare workers that have given the ultimate sacrifice or have gotten very sick, had major effects on their lives, even if they, Baruch Hashem, survived. What does halacha have to say about taking such risks? So I'll bring you a Yerushalmi. It's Yerushalmi in Trumas, in the 8th parak. A very, very interesting story. The Gemara says that Rav Imi was captured. He's captured by a marauding band. Troublemakers. The PLO of his day. And Amar Rav Yonason, Rav Yonason came, and he said, prepare the tachrichim. That's it. You're never going to get such a person back. They're going to kill him. All we can do is bury him. That's all we're allowed to do. We can't take him back. Up jumps Rav Shimon ben Lakish. Reish Lakish. The famous first generation Amoru. And he said, Ado ono kotil, ono miskatil. The Pnei Moshe explains, and he says, O ani eherog, O ani neherag. I will go kill him, the band of marauders that have captured my friend Ravimi, or they will kill me. In other words, I'm going to go and save him. I will put myself obviously at some risk, or at least on the surface of this reading, he's saying, I'm willing to put myself at risk, and maybe they will kill me, or I will kill them, and I will save Ravim. Gemara continues and says that he was very successful in what he did. He went to the kidnappers and he was able to convince them to give Ravim back to him. And he said, by the way, would you guys like to get a bracha from my Rebbe? He'll give you a bracha. You've been so nice. My Rebbe, Rav Yochanan, will give you a bracha. They said, yeah, why not? Take a bracha. So they went to Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan says, what you wanted to do to Ravimi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should do to you. And they didn't make it to the next destination. They all died. I'll tell you the end of the story. That's not related to our discussion, but it's an interesting end of the story. And God always works things out. You never have to worry. We always have the ultimate even outer on our side. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will work everything out. Things look very bleak sometimes. Is this Gemara Halacha L'maisa? What did Reish Lakish do? Reish Lakish went and put himself at great risk. He didn't know he would be able to convince them. It was going to come down to a battle, possibly. A battle he might very well lose. Yet, he was willing to put himself at risk to save his fellow Jew. Is this halacha l'maisa? Can we say, well, if Reish Lakish can do it, I can do it. So many say that we do not paskin like this Yerushalmi. We often don't paskin like Yerushalmis when there's a bavli against them. So this set off a scramble amongst the poskim to say, well, where's the bavli that argues with this? We do paskin like Yerushalmis when there's no bavli that argues with them. So where is the bavli? So there are a number of different poskim to try to bring down different bavlis that seem to be against this. Maybe one or two which I'll mention later on for time considerations. I won't go into that in detail right now. There are three reasons that are brought down by the Tzitz Eliezer. He brings down three reasons why this is not a raya. Even if you want to say that we hold like this Yerushalmi, it doesn't give you a blanket heter to put yourself at grave risk in order to save another Jew. At grave risk to save another Jew. And he brings three reasons. He said, number one, we don't paskin like Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish usually loses when he argues against Rav Yonah's son or Rav Yochanan or against many of the other Amorayim of his generation. So, okay, Reish Lakish did this. There are only three places in all of Shas that we paskin like Reish Lakish over Rav Yochanan. And this isn't one of them. So we don't paskin like Reish Lakish. Simple. Maybe that Yerushalmi would suggest that you could. We don't paskin like that Yerushalmi. We don't need a Babli against it. It's Reish Lakish. Number two. He says, who says that what Reish Lakish did is actual halachic practice? You can't bring a proof from what Reish Lakish did that that's a normative halacha. Maybe he went beyond normative halacha, what we would call a midus chassidus. He was a wonderful, nice, great person. That doesn't mean that you're obligated to do this. You're allowed to do this, maybe, but you're not obligated to do this. So if somebody wishes to take the risk, you could argue you'd be allowed to take the risk, but you couldn't fault someone for not wanting to take the risk. You can't bring a proof from this Gemara that you're mechuyev, obligated to take the risk. And the third reason is one that I personally like the best. And that's if you know a little bit of the historical background. I love to hear the stories behind the stories. Who was Reish Lakish? So Reish Lakish was a gladiator. Chazal tell us, there's a machlokis amongst the commentators as to whether Reish Lakish was originally good, became bad, and then became good again. Or he was just originally bad and then he became good. Either way, he was a feared armed robber himself. He was a tough guy. And you know why Reish Lakish could go against this band of marauding kidnappers? 1 against 10 or whatever the numbers were? Because it was no contest. It was a guaranteed win. It's me going up against Mike Tyson. It's not a contest. It's not a fair battle. It wasn't, wow, he's putting himself at risk. It's Reish Lakish going in and just walking past all the band and taking back Ravini. There was no risk involved. He was the toughest gladiator. He was an armed, strong person. Chazal tell us that originally he was able to jump over an entire river, then he became a Talmid Chacham, he was no longer able to do it. It says the Torah weakens you. You sit in the Beis Medrash for 12, 14, 16 hours a day, so you're not going to be able to jump over the river. But you get a lot of other rewards to make it an even balance. So that's how, again, there are different ways that we can say that this Gemara is not Lahalach. Either we find the Babli that argues with it, or we say that even within the Yerushalmi itself, you can't bring a raya that a physician is obligated to take a risk. Let's look at another Babli, a Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara says, this is in the 8th Perek Daf Ayin Gimel, the Gemara says, "Minayin l'roa es chavero shehu toveya binor." How do we know that if you see a friend drowning in the river, "Ol chayo goroso," you see a lion dragging him, "Ol listin b'inolav," you see armed robbers attacking him, "Shehu chayev latzilo," that you are obligated to save him. So we bring down psukim and we prove very true. I'm not going to go through the actual drushes. We bring down psukim that you are obligated to save him. Is this halacha l'maisa? So some would suggest, and the Hagos, Maimonios, brings this down. He says that you see from here that in fact a person is putting himself at risk. A person who's drowning, any lifeguard will tell you there's a risk. No matter how good a swimmer you are, no matter how strong you are, a drowning person can pull you under. And going up against armed robbers again, so you have a machine gun, they have a machine gun. There's a risk involved. The lion, well, you may think you can take the lion, but the lion thinks otherwise. So there's obviously a risk involved, and yet you see that the Gemara says that you have to take this risk. It says you have to. Chayav latzilo. Here we get very specific. We don't say you have the option, not the... Chayav lehatzilo. You must save his life. So the Hagos Maimonios, as well as the Kesef Mishnah, who brings down the Hagos Maimonios, he says that this shows that we paskin like that Yerushalmi. You see that that's the halacha lemaisa, like Reish Lakish did, is halacha lemaisa. And therefore, he says, afilu lahaknis asmo b'sofek sakona, even if it means putting yourself at some risk, chayav, a person is obligated to put himself at some risk in order to save someone else's life. Why? So here the Kesef Mishnah adds on his own, v'nira shahatam, the reason is, mipnei shahalov vadai hu safek. Because this person is certainly going to die. This is an absolute. If you don't do something for this person, he will definitely die. And there's only a safek chance. He's going to drown. Maybe I'll drown if I jump in. Maybe I won't. So your safek is not strong enough to prevent you from saving this person's vadai. That's how the Hagos Maimonios paskins. Kesef Mishnah brings this down. He says this is, he wants to read this into the Rambam too, but it's not straight from the reading of the Rambam. The Tzitz Eliezer points out on this. He says, where do you see in this Gemara how much of a risk you're putting yourself in? It doesn't say Betheirish over here that you're putting yourself at risk. He also brings down a famous Gemara elsewhere, a machlokas between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Patira. This is a classical story where people were walking in the desert, two people were walking in the desert, and one guy drops his canteen, oops, and there's only one canteen left, and there's not enough water for both of them to survive. So if one person takes all the water for himself, he will survive, and his buddy, unfortunately, will pass away from dehydration. If they share the water, both will live a little bit, but ultimately both will die. So Ben Patira says, well, both got to share the water. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, one person can keep the water for himself. So the Tzitz Eliezer says, this Gemara argues, since we paskin like Rabbi Akiva, this Gemara would argue with the opinion over here of the Hagos Maimonios. So again, we're left with no clear-cut raya, according to the Tzitz Eliezer, according to the way most understand this. So let's go on in history. Let's see how we paskin in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat, Tav Chav Vav, brings down the Sanhedrin Gemara about the person drowning or the lion taking him, and quotes this Gemara verbatim, V'yachol lahatzilohu b'yatzmo, as long as you have the potential, there's no mitzvah, you don't know how to swim, there's no mitzvah to jump into the water. As long as you have the ability to save him, you're allowed to. Or you can hire somebody else to save him. If you don't, you're over alo samod al damri yechol. Okay? Now, on this, the Meir HaSeinayim quotes as follows. He says, V'nira, he brings down what the Hagos Maimonios and the Kesef Mishnah say, and he adds, the Mechaber doesn't write down that you are Mechuyiv to do this. He says, the Mechaber doesn't write this down, the Rambam doesn't write it down, and he says, the Rif doesn't write it down, the Rosh doesn't write it down, the Tur doesn't write it down, and he says, we don't paskin like that Gemara. And it's not brought down la halacha, because a person has no obligation to give up his own life, even in a suffix, to save somebody else's life. That's what he says. He brings down other reasons as well why we don't have to. That's how he says we paskin. So if we just leave it over here, looks like a person would have the right to walk into the hospital and say, oh, the saw's here, and turn right around and go home. To the person who would be. Obligated to go and do it. He says, since your life is as important as his life, if not equally important, more important, he says, even though in this situation you may not be obligated to, he says, v'lo l'daktek b'yoser. Don't be so exact. Well, there's a point, one chance over here that something's going to happen to me. I'm not going in. And he says, the way you treat other people will be the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu treats you. And if you're so exact on all of these things, then God will be just as exact with you. Does anybody else hold like this? Yes. Shulchan Aruch HaRav says the exact same lashon. They're all really basing it on Pisrei Tshuva. Says the exact same lashon as the Mishnah Berurah. Major post, Mishnah Berurah, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and the Aruch HaShulchan says the same thing. Hakol lefi ha'inyon. You have to look at the individual circumstances. Yesh lishkol ha'inyon befeles. You have to evaluate this on a scale, a basket on a scale. V'lo lishmar atzmo yoser midai. A physician can't say, well, there's a risk, I'm not going in. Physician has to take what is an acceptable risk, but can't take unnecessary risks. And he says, and this he ends, kol ha'mekayim nefesh miyisrael. You're able to save one life, kayim olam ole. It's as if you saved the entire world. There are many more tshuvas on this general subject, but they all basically come down to the same idea. And the Tzitz Eliezer of Waldenburg Shlita, Eretz Yisrael, one of the major poskim in Jewish medical halachic issues, states clearly in his several tshuvas the idea that a physician is allowed to accept reasonable risks in order to save another person's life. And this is the basis, really, of the secular idea that the medical societies have come out that a physician is not allowed to shirk his responsibility. This came really to the fore with the HIV epidemic, how physicians who would not take care of HIV patients would be subject to sanctions or would be subject to licensure loss, etc. Would be subject to lawsuits in the United States. I don't know about here in Canada. This is a credo, if you wish, that has come from halacha into mainstream secular ethics of our profession, that says that a physician is expected to take certain risks, reasonable risks. So what I'd like to do in the few minutes that I have left, again, there are many poskim that say this, for time considerations I won't go into all of them, is try and discuss now the application specifically to SARS. One of the things that we can see from here, I think, is that one cannot today, with our knowledge of infection control and our ability to use N95 masks, particulate respirator masks to filter out viruses of the size of SARS, and certainly if you have access to or ability to use even better particulate respirators, an N97, an N99, they're purified air particulate respirators known as PAPRs that can be worn that are possibly superior even to these, although a lot more cumbersome and certainly a lot more expensive. It appears to me from, I feel more comfortable talking about my medical knowledge than I do about halachic knowledge. It appears to me from a medical point of view that there are essentially no infectious diseases today that we have, if we know about what the patient has, that is, that we can't to a reasonable extent protect the health caregiver. And therefore, it would seem to me that in general, with possibly certain exceptions being posed, for example, in somebody doing certain very specific procedures where the risk might be greater, in general, one would have halachic sanction without any doubt to go and take care of patients who have very severe infectious diseases, presuming that they take appropriate precautions. If you're going to do a bronchoscopy on a patient who has SARS without a respirator, I don't think halacha would sanction that. That would already provoke such a high level of risk that the poskim would not allow such a thing. However, to do it with appropriate infection control, and that's a medical question, what is appropriate infection control for that setting? Halacha bases its psak on what the doctors tell is the facts of medicine. So assuming appropriate infection control measures are taken, there wouldn't appear to be a problem in a physician taking care of patients with SARS or any other healthcare person taking care of patients with SARS. What about other health care providers, such as were described, who aren't physicians, aren't nurses, aren't paid? So certainly, stam biker cholim, just to come in and have a nice, bright, cheery face, come in to cheer up a patient. So there you have a different level of benefit to the patient, and halacha would not necessarily sanction such people entering into the room. In fact, there are poskim that had brought down that one wouldn't be allowed to walk into a leper's room. In the past, they thought that leprosy was far more contagious than it is today. However, we have great gedolim that didn't have that concern. There's a famous story about Rav Aryeh Levin, the great tzaddik of Yerushalayim, that would regularly, every Friday, go and visit the leper colony. There were 12 little Jewish children there, I think, amongst many, many other people. And he had no concerns, even though previous authorities had in fact said that that's a dangerous thing to do. So again, one might suggest that the medical knowledge has changed. Leprosy is not an especially contagious disease. And if it were, maybe the facts would be different. But again, a person who's doing stam biker cholim would have a different level of authority, a lower level of authority to go into the room to do routine things than a physician or a real caregiver. Where a person who's a companion, or where a person who is providing essential, necessary services, but maybe they could be fulfilled by somebody else, so then if there is another person that's capable of doing it, the better part of prudence would be not to put yourself at risk. But we can't allow somebody to die from lack of food. That would have the same obligation for a physician to go in and try to take care of the patient. So if there was nobody able to feed the patient, obviously you'd be allowed to, again, apply appropriate infection control and take care of the patient's basic needs. I think that would be clear as well. Some of the other issues that were raised both here tonight and in other conversations that I've had with some of the organizers of this symposium, and again, I give them tremendous hakaras hatov for having such an important symposium. I think it's very important that people be aware of what the medical risks are, and people should be aware of what the halachic issues are. Some of the other issues that were raised, well, what about the requirement to have a clean-shaven face if you want to wear an N95 respirator? The official recommendation from the CDC and other organizations, NIOSH and the United States, OSHA and various other organizations, is that you cannot get a good seal, a good fit, if you have facial hair. Incidentally, they also say you can't get a good fit if you're wearing a yarmulke or if you're wearing contact lenses. Those are other regulations that they have. So as a person who wears a yarmulke, has a beard, and wears contact lenses sometimes, this is a wonderful problem. So we actually addressed this in a non-halachic way. I addressed this in a medical way. We presented a paper about 7 years ago at one of the infection control meetings about doing fit testing on people with beards to see if they could have a successful fit. And in fact, many people, although certainly not all people with beards, can have a successful fit test. And I would suggest that as number one, as a practical consideration, is see what type of beard the person has. They have a real bushy beard, you're not going to get a good fit. If you have a better trimmed beard, you need to do a fit test and see medically what the issue is, and then you can present the halachic question. If there is, in fact, no medical concern, then there's no halachic concern. If there is a medical concern, the person has the type of a beard that, for whatever the reason, cannot allow a good fit, so then there are several options. Number one is to use a PAPR, a purified air particulate respirator, which doesn't require a person to be clean-shaven and can, in fact, be worn by a person who has a beard and will provide at least as good, if not better, protection. The only problem with that is a financial consideration. It becomes quite expensive for an institution to have to provide PAPRs at about $500 a pop versus a buck or two for a N95. So this becomes a financial consideration, not as much a halachic consideration. If the PAPRs are either not available or are too excessive in terms of cost to become a practical consideration, so then again, it appears to me that there are poskim that allow you to shave with various implements that don't involve an issa d'oraisa, might not even involve an issa d'rabbanan, according to most poskim. Again, a person needs to ask specific halachi shailas to his particular rav, but in general, it would appear to me that there are many, many poskim that would allow a person in that situation to shave in a halachically permissible way. It wouldn't involve cutting off the peyot, which is the real iser. And if one could do it in a halachically permissible way, so that certainly would be another option in this situation. One of the other questions that was addressed was, what about the cutting off of a minyan? There's a minyan in the institution, but the outside people that are necessary to make the minyan or wish to participate in the minyan are not being allowed to enter. So I actually found an interesting tshuva as well in the Tzitz Eliezer. It was just a wealth of information on this subject. And he quotes as follows from a tshuva from the Gaon Rav Pelagi. And he says as follows. They told him about a rofe cholim, about a doctor, shebizman magefa, in the time of a certain magefa that they had, hayarofe lenigofin b'magefa. He was the infection control officer. He was the guy in charge of taking care of all these sick patients. And what did he want to do? After a hard day's work, he wanted to go to home to the base medrash, relax at a shir, go daven mincha mariv, and guess what? Nobody else wanted him in the minyan. Can't imagine why. I mean, people don't like to shake my hand as it is. As soon as they tell them I'm an ID guy, oh, nice to know you. They didn't want him in the minyan. So, Hayehudim ma'akhtim biyodo shaloli kones. They didn't want him to enter into the minyan. Shem yureim, shem yisnakbu benogei love. They were afraid they'd catch whatever he had. So he says, it's not a shiloh. He says over here, he says that you see from there whether they have the right to prevent it from entering or not, but you clearly see he says you clearly see from here without getting into the shalom could they prevent the rofe from going in or not. He says clearly you see that the rofe had a right to go. So he brings this down as an additional point. Clearly the rofe could put himself in danger. As to whether the rofe would be allowed to put everybody else in danger, again, I would suggest that this is dependent upon the medical facts. The medical facts will determine what the halacha has to say. The halacha doesn't change. The medical facts change. Each case needs to be looked at in an individual case-by-case basis. And if, in fact, the medical facts determine that it's risky to allow people from the community to come in, pikuach nefesh is doches hakol, except for the three cardinal sins. Our concern for human life overrides all of the commandments in the Torah with the exception of the three cardinal sins of Gila Araish, Shvich HaZdom, and Avodah Zarah, of various sexual impropriety and immorality, of worshipping foreign gods, of Avodah Zarah, worshipping idols, and killing another person. You can't save your life if it causes another person to be killed. Kill him or else I'll kill you. You have to say, well, kill me. So except for those three, we override all of the Torah's prohibitions because we say, better to override this one principle now and observe it for many, many years to come. So again, if the medical facts, which may be controversial, but if after assessment from a scientific and medical rigorous point of view, it's determined that opening up this shul would be a danger, so then it's clear that halacha says you have to close the shul. You're not allowed to have that shul open if it's going to pose a further health risk. I remember one time that my Rebbein told me a story that it was on Yom Kippur, but I don't remember if it was Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av, and there was a cholera epidemic, and the Rav sent everyone home from shul and told them to go home and drink, because it was obviously a danger. So clearly, if there's a danger posed by having the presence of the minyan, the halacha would say that you're allowed to close the minyan. The only questions would be, is it truly a danger or not? That's for the medical facts to be presented, and then the halacha has to tell you what the halacha is. Finally, the last question that was raised that I just wanted to address, and with this I'll close, is the idea of the shiva. Another question that was raised in a similar regard was the idea of an autopsy. Chas v'shalom, if one of these patients was Jewish, would you be allowed to perform an autopsy? So the shiva and autopsy questions I'll take together. Basically, the halacha tells us that you sit shiva. The halacha doesn't require anybody else to be there. It's obviously something that we try to do, to have people come and be menachem, the person sitting shiva. But that's not an essential requirement. The person has to sit shiva. The other people are coming and fulfilling their mitzvah. If for technical reasons they're unable to come, again, because it's dangerous, so then you're still sitting shiva. So that doesn't appear to me to be a problem. Obviously, you'd like it to be done in a way that we normally sit shiva. The person has to sit shiva, lo aleinu, so we know the rules and the way we sit shiva. But it can't, again, it's not done at the expense of pikuach nefesh. The autopsy question is, again, a very similar idea. Autopsies are allowed to be done in specific situations. The Noda B'Yehuda has a classical tshuva on this, And he says, chola lefaneinu. You need to have a person with a similar illness right there in front of you. And how we define right there in front of you may have changed over time with emails and with ability to communicate over vast distances in very short periods of time. A chola lefaneinu may be somebody in Hong Kong versus somebody in Toronto. That may be chola lefaneinu. So the halacha clearly sanctions, and the great posim of clearly sanctioned with Moshe has in various tshuvas, clear sanction that a person can do an autopsy. It's permissible in halacha, possibly even required, therefore, in halacha, to do an autopsy if the information to be gained will benefit a sick person right there and then with the same illness. So that's a very simple, straightforward answer. Again, one certainly needs to consult with a rabbi before one takes that as a blanket heter. Every case needs to be looked at individually. Sometimes the medical profession feels that every patient should have an autopsy. That's certainly not what the halacha has to say. I'll conclude my remarks with a question that was asked to me at the very beginning before we had a formal presentation here by one of the conveners of this presentation tonight. And he said, nobody's ever talked about why we have SARS. That's already much deeper than I can go into. But I'll tell you a famous vart I heard over from the Skelina Rebbe. I didn't hear this directly. I heard this from my Rebbe, who heard this from the Skelina Rebbe Zatzal, went through the Holocaust. Skelina Rebbe was at one time captured and in tremendous distress in some jail. And they took away his tefillin, they took away his yarmulke, they took away everything. And he tried to daven as best as he could anyway, of course. Put his jacket over his head. Wouldn't walk around with a bare cap, bare head while he was davening. And he came up to the tefillah of Baruch She'omar. And in the tefillah of Baruch She'omar, he started davening with kavana. And it came to Baruch Gozer U'Mekayim. God is the Blessed One. He makes decrees and he fulfills them. That's the literal taich. That's the literal explanation. He couldn't understand, what does this mean? Baruch Gozer U'Mekayim. Everything here is a praise to God, all the praises and shevach that we're giving the Ribono Shel Olam. What praise does it say that he makes decrees and then he fulfills them? We hope that he makes decrees and he doesn't fulfill them, right? There's a terrible decree with SARS. We don't want what's going on in Shemayim to continue, telling us that we have this terrible machala. So then he came, said, that's not the pshat. That's not the understanding that the words mean. God makes decrees and he is mekayim those decrees. He fulfills those decrees. He says, no. Baruch Gozer, Hashem makes his decrees. U'mekayim, he makes the people who he makes those decrees on able to withstand those decrees. He's Gozer and he's mekayim the people that have the decree on them. Why this SARS, I don't know. I do know that if we didn't have the ability to take care of this problem on a scientific, medical, religious basis, we wouldn't have the problem. God doesn't give us problems that we can't handle. We don't always handle them as well as we could. But God doesn't give us problems that we can't handle. Otherwise, we lose our Bechira Chofshi. If a person has too much weight on him and he collapses, it's not a test. We all have tests in life. This is a test. Why? Go talk to your spiritual advisor. But I guarantee you that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us the ability to withstand this test. I'll make one last comment and then I'll close. There's a famous story in the Gemara about a rabbi that was offered a jewel to sell. But he was in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei. He was in the middle of davening Shemoneh Esrei. So the guy says, I'll buy the jewel from you for $10,000. Continue shuckling your Shemoneh Esrei. Guy says, if you must say, he doesn't answer me, oh, he wants more. I'll give you $20,000. And he shuckles some more. I'll give you $30,000. He finishes the Shemoneh Esrei. And the Gemara says, he said, listen, I don't want to gain. I'll take the $10,000. That's all I asked for. I was just finishing my Shemoneh Esrei. So Rebbe told this story to the kids. And he said, what would you kids do? So he goes to one kid in the class, the kid says, well, I think, okay, $10,000 is the right thing. Another kid said, well, I don't know, $30,000 is the right thing. He said to another kid, and what would you do? He said, I'd have davened a longer Shemoneh Esrei. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, I don't know how long we're going to go on now, how long a Shemoneh Esrei we're going to say, but we're at Modim at least. So we'll have now, Haizvash will give a short presentation, a PowerPoint presentation, remind us of Dr. Benny, who we miss from these conferences, who always had a PowerPoint presentation, and then we'll take questions and answers. So I don't think this is going to be a long presentation, but then we can answer your questions. Thank you. I don't know if we want to turn off the light. Yeah, take the microphone.
I don't have a laser pointer, and I don't have an advancer thing. So just if you could just hit the space bar, okay. No, just space. This bar? No. As the rabbi was just alluding to, where did SARS come from? It came from Guangdong province, which is the neighboring province near Hong Kong on mainland China. And Guangdong province apparently has 80 million people. And there was an outbreak of atypical pneumonia in this region in November, and there are at least 305 patients who are associated with that outbreak. Next slide, please. So in February, a physician from this area was visiting a hotel in Hong Kong. Next slide. And on a couple from Canada was staying at the same hotel during the same time period. And after they returned to Toronto, the wife developed a fever and cough, and this is the patient who died in her house that Dr. Rose had alluded to.
That is a prize, right?
Yeah. Now, here, just some interesting things. All these things about scanners and thermal scanners and airport scanners and screening travelers and everything. No thermal scanner would have picked up this patient. Number one, because she didn't have a fever when she returned to Canada. And number two, she didn't come from Hong Kong. She came from Newark, New Jersey, because she flew Continental Airlines. And she had a stopover in New Jersey. And so when she arrived in Toronto, it would have said, you know, New Jersey. It wouldn't have said Hong Kong or Beijing or Vietnam. So it was any kind of screening implementation, unless you screened every single person coming in and out of Toronto, by all routes, would not have picked up the first patient who was the index patient who all cases thus far have been tied to. Next slide. So, as I mentioned earlier, on the 14th, the patient who presented to York Central Hospital was in the eMERGE when the son of that first patient was in the eMERGE and contracted SARS, and then was readmitted on the 14th and then transferred to York Central Hospital on the 16th. Next slide. Then the wife of that patient presented on the 21st and was admitted to the surgical service. Next slide. So we had three staff in our ICU. Dr. Rose had alluded to the fear of the hit rates in terms of the number of people exposed versus the number of people infected. Fortunately, the hit rate in the intensive care unit was probably about 1 in 30. We had about 90 staff that we could say had been in the intensive care unit during the period of unprotected exposure. And fortunately, only 3 intensive care unit staff got sick. And then we were shut down on the 29th. Next slide. So we had a total of 10... from the outbreak in our hospital, 10 staff and 3 patients. And characteristic of the outbreak in Toronto in general in that most of the people who got sick were actually healthcare workers. Next slide. So it's caused by a coronavirus, which is, again, I'm not an infectious disease expert, but it's in the family of cold viruses. It's an RNA-based virus, and it causes the atypical pneumonia, which is typical in any other way to a typical pneumonia, other than the microbiologic result in terms of the organisms that caused the lung infection. Next slide. This is what it looks like. The arrow, the bar in the corner is 100 nanometers or 1/10,000th of a millimeter. So they're small, little buggers. Next slide. This is what's called a cladogram, and it's it shows the genetic distance of the coronavirus to all the other major coronaviruses that are identified. And most coronaviruses don't infect humans. Most infect other animals, and the MH1 is infects mouse, and there's a rat one, and then there's porcine viruses, and the human one is the one that's sitting, I think it says SARS beside it. It's hard for me to see over here, but in the bottom right-hand side is the SARS one. It's closest to the category 2 group of viruses, which include the rat and the mouse one. Next slide.
For those who don't look at chest x-rays very often, the lungs are normally black on a chest x-ray because they're filled with air and x-rays pass right through air. If they hit something solid like fluid or bone, it gets blocked and the film behind the person doesn't get developed. So the lungs are normally black, and you can hear the right, this is the right side of the lung. So this is all the back of the lung. This is the right lung, this is the left lung. You can see here it's dark and here it's a little bit fluffy white. Someone presenting with SARS, and this is somebody as it progresses, you can see it started off on one side, and then both sides, and a little bit in the upper lobe. And this is later on in the recovery phase, there's still some persistent, what we call infiltrates or opacities on the chest x-ray that persist. And that looks like any other pneumonia that people can get by any other cause. There's nothing on the x-ray that differentiates it from a different cause of pneumonia. Next slide. So it's not, this is the good news, it's not easily transmitted in the wider community. It's something that the incubator for this is hospitals. It's aside from the initial family, the vast majority of people have gotten in hospitals, even though the vast majority of exposures are really still in the community. It's just not something that's spread easily in the community. And fortunately, that's why there are only 10,000 or 8,500 known cases as opposed to 85 million known cases. In the hospital setting, it can be very easily spread when precautions are not in place. When precautions are in place, it's actually very difficult to spread, and the very few cases where there has been spread with precautions, when you actually look at the precautions that were used, they were less than optimal. Next slide, please. 25% of patients require intensive care unit stay. This is the Toronto experience, and 90% of those patients were requiring mechanical ventilation or being on a breathing machine. And the overall mortality for patients with SARS pneumonia is about 10%. And the vast majority of people who've died have been the elderly, as well as people with other chronic illnesses. Although being old is not a chronic illness. So. Next slide. This is the Toronto data showing SARS outcomes over the first several weeks. And you can see that patients over 60 made up the vast majority of patients who died. The lower the curve gets, the greater the mortality. Next slide. This breaks it down based on comorbidity. So patients who are diabetic had a fourfold relative increase in their risk of developing a complication. This isn't actually death. This is a complication of SARS. And they defined a bad outcome as either requiring admission to intensive care unit, requiring support on a breathing machine, or death. So that was a composite endpoint that they looked at in the Toronto data. Next slide. So there's no known treatment of pruritus for the most part. Are quite ill in terms of both physically and emotionally. The physical illness lasts
weeks in terms of the recovery phase in which they're, you know, tired, fatigued, may have some breathing symptoms, respiratory symptoms in terms of persistent cough or shortness of breath that can last several weeks. Initially, there was this big bandwagon for a drug called ribavirin, and the doses which we were using were the same doses that they would give for Ebola virus or other hemorrhagic fevers, and the side effects at those doses were astronomically high. The majority of patients had severe anemia as related to it, related to the drug, and it just made people feel tremendously unwell. And in fact, ribavirin was associated independently with a poor outcome, and it was stopped within a few days. And one of the interesting things in these teleconferences that we participated in, we did a straw poll: is who actually thinks, because everyone was using it, because no one. Everyone felt that they had to give something, and that's what was recommended. And then we did a straw poll and asked all the physicians taking care of SARS patients, did they actually think this drug was helping? And not a single physician, including David Rose, said we all thought it was useless. And after that day, nobody got ribavirin in Toronto. There's some empirical data that, and just clinical gestalt that steroid seems to make a difference, that people tend to, the fever goes away, their chest x-ray seems to clear up faster, whether it actually has a mortality benefit in terms of preventing death, it's completely unknown. Next slide. So this is the epi curve for Toronto. The blue is hospital-acquired infections, the reds are imported cases, the yellow ones are imported cases. The red ones are family members of hospital workers or family members of patients, so family, close family contacts who develop SARS. And then there's some funny hash mark ones, which refers to the Filipino religious group where there was a small cluster of cases. Next slide. You can see that curve went up very quickly and down very quickly. And that's based on the date of onset. And the peak date of onset, the peak of the curve was the 27th of March. So the disease actually already peaked before we even implemented the infection control precautions citywide. This is the most recent one from the internet today. And that second blip is the current wave that's going through the hospitals in the east side of Toronto. And again, it's virtually all hospital-acquired infections, mostly hospital workers with some patients. Next slide. This is the worldwide epidemiologic curve. Unfortunately, they don't have the data to report it based on symptom onset, so they do it by reporting. So you see these huge, tremendous spikes from China that says, oh, we found 400 cases we forgot about. And suddenly there'd be this big spike one day. But generally, it also has grumbles along, peaks around the middle of March, and it's been consistently going down in terms of the number of cases reported each day. Next slide. This is the worldwide curve in terms of the concentration based on countries that have more than 100 cases, and the only country that has more than 100 active cases is China. Next slide. Can you go back? Actually, never mind. It'll confuse it. The very interesting thing when they slapped the travel ban on Toronto, one of the reasons was that the World Health Organization said is we need to prevent international transfer to other countries to protect the third world, because if Hong Kong, which has a very sophisticated healthcare system, and if Toronto, which has a very sophisticated healthcare system, can't get this under control, if this hits Africa, God help Africa, because they're not going to be able to deal with it. And this is what the Secretary General of the World Health Organization said. And the first country to eradicate SARS was Vietnam, which I find very interesting. So it is possible to get a lid on it, and it is possible to contain it, and it is possible, realistic, that this outbreak in Toronto will be over in the near while. Next slide. And last, this is we published a lot, And one of our experience from New York Central Hospital was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal last week. And I got a call from the editor of the China Medical Tribune in Beijing asking us to translate it into Chinese so that, you know, the doctors in China could have it as a monograph. And they actually translated the entire article minus the tables and the figures into Chinese, which I think is a great souvenir. I think it's the last slide. Next slide. Outbreak. And you have to read the very fine print at the bottom that says, try to remain calm. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Hari, for the excellent presentation. So we're going to get everyone up to the... why don't you sit up there too, Rabbi Kalman? And... to the panel. We're going to take some questions. Just while we're while Hai is putting away his machine, I'd just like to remind everyone to please fill in the evaluations. They're very critical to us in terms of running future programs. If we get that information, it helps us get accreditation for future programs and guides us into the programs we're going to do. And also, if you did not sign the email list on the way in, could you please sign it on the way out so that we can trace you,
right?
So that we can inform you of future programs. Okay, anyone like to...
We're getting the evaluation forms. One person went. You don't have to all run to get them. We'll bring them back in.
Okay, someone's bringing in the evaluation forms. So, go ahead. Do you want to come up to the microphone? Probably best if you do, because we're taping this, so we'd really like to have it on the microphone.
My question is the transmission in Hong Kong and China, is that the same as ours in Toronto, where it's hospital-based transmission? We didn't hear about anything like that of how the Hong Kong and China experience spread. I assume it's not in hospital, but it's in community. And if that is the case, how do you account for that? Are there two different SARS diseases going on?
It's a very good question. The data in Hong Kong is quite clear that it's a hospital-based disease in Hong Kong and in China. And the exception is when you consider a hospital-based infection, that includes the family context of hospital workers. So if you include those people, the vast majority of people worldwide have been hospital-based infections. So although it's a community-acquired pneumonia, it's still predominantly a hospital-based infection. That's where some of the schizophrenia that Dr. Rose alluded to earlier comes into, because the public health in general, you know, their expertise is in Canada, we don't have the CDC. Well, we use the CDC, but we don't have our own CDC. And public health is very good in terms of community-acquired illnesses. But their expertise, at least in Canada, in terms of hospital outbreaks and nosocomial infections, is not to the nth degree as the CDC would have. And so public health, you know, it's a degree in community medicine, and that's what it focuses on. And the understanding of public health, of the complexities of hospital-based care, and that's seen a lot from the directives that we've received over the past number of weeks and months, makes it, it shows some of the weaknesses in the current system. But the data from the Hong Kong and the published data, it's virtually all hospital cases. You know, the big thing was when they shut down one of the teaching hospitals in Hong Kong that became affected, and we were like, oh my gosh, you know, that'll never happen here. You know, what are they doing that wrong? But it's something that in the hospital setting, without if the clinical suspicion's not there, and you get a case, and it's very interesting, the outbreak in the hospital in Hong Kong that they reported on in the New England Journal of Medicine, the initial patient was on BiPAP, on non-invasive ventilation. That was the first paper, I believe around the 7th of April, it was posted on the internet that